Chapter 4. There is a moment when the moor comes to life. I wish you could see it, but somehow, whenever I have been with you on our walks through the countryside, we have missed those few precious hours of revelation. Instead, the skies have been the slate grey of the stones beneath them, or drought turns the land to dust-brown thorns, or once it snowed so hard that the kitchen door was barred shut from the outside, and I had to climb out of the window to shovel us a path to freedom. And on one trip in 1949, it rained continually, I believe, for 5 days without end. You never saw it for those few hours after rain, when all is purple and yellow and smells of black, rich soil. Your deduction, made early on in our friendship, that I was born in the north of England, for all of my pretensions and mannerisms acquired over many lives, was entirely correct. And my adopted father, Patrick August, never let me forget it. He was the sole groundsman on the Hewn estate, and had been so for as long as he had lived. So had his father before him, and his father before him, as far back as 1834, when the newly rich Hewn family bought the land to sculpt their ideal upper-class dream. They planted trees, drove roads through the moor, built ridiculous towers and arches, folly by name and folly by nature, which, by the time of my birth, had sunk into moss-crawled decline. Not for them the grubby scrubland that framed the estate with its rock teeth and sticky gums of earth and flesh. Previous, energetic generations of the family had kept sheep, or perhaps it would be fairer to say that the sheep had kept themselves, on the wide places beneath the stone walls. But the 20th century had not been kind to the fortunes of the Hewns, and now the land, though still theirs, was left untended, wild, the perfect place for a boy to run free while his parents were about their chores. Curiously enough, living my childhood again, I found myself far less adventurous. Holes and crags that I had climbed along and leapt in my first life, to my more conservative elder brain, suddenly seemed places of danger, and I wore my child's body as an old woman might wear a skinny bikini bought for her by a fragile friend. Having failed so spectacularly to end the cycle of my days by suicide, I resolved on my third life to instead pursue the answers that seemed so far away. It is some small mercy, I believe, that our memories return to us slowly as we progress through childhood, so that the recollection of having thrown myself to my death came, as it were, like a gently gathering cold, arriving with no sense of surprise, merely an acceptance that this thing was and had achieved nothing. My first life, for all it lacked any real direction, had about it a kind of happiness, if ignorance is innocence and loneliness is a separation of care. But my new life, with its knowledge of all that had come before, could not be lived the same. It wasn't merely awareness of events yet to come, but rather a new perception of the truths around me, which, being a child, raised to them in my first life, I had not even considered to be lies. Now, a boy again, and temporarily at least in command of my full adult faculties, I perceived the truths which are so often acted out in front of a child's sight in the belief that a child cannot comprehend them. I believe that my adopted father and mother came to love me, she far sooner than he. But for Patrick August, I was never flesh of his flesh until my adopted mother died. There is a medical study in this phenomenon, but my adopted mother never quite dies upon the same day in each life she lives. The cause, unless external factors intervene violently first, is always the same. Around my 6th birthday, she begins to cough, and by my 7th, her coughing is bloody. My parents cannot afford the doctor's fees, but my Aunt Alexandra finally furnishes the coin for my mother to go to the hospital in Newcastle and receive a diagnosis of lung cancer. I believe it to be non-small cell carcinomas, confined primarily to the left lung, frustratingly treatable some 40 years after my mother's diagnosis, but utterly beyond the realms of science at the time. Tobacco and laudanum are prescribed, and death swiftly follows in 1927. At her death, my father falls into a silence and walks upon the hills, sometimes not to be seen for many days. I tend to myself perfectly competently, and now, in expectation of my mother's death, stockpile some food to see me through his long absences. On his return, he remains silent and unapproachable, and though he does not rise to any approaches from my infant self with anger, that is largely because he does not rise at all. In my first life, I did not understand his grief, nor how it manifested, for I myself was grieving with the blind wordlessness of a child who needed help, which he did not provide. In my second life, my mother's death happened while I was still under the asylum roof, and I was too concerned with my own madness to process it. But in my third, it came as a slow-moving train towards a man tied to the tracks. Inevitable. Unstoppable. Seen far off in the night, and the imagination of the thing, for me, almost worse than the event. I knew what was to come, and somehow, when it came, it was a relief, an ending of expectation, and so a lesser event. In my third life, my mother's impending death also gave me something of an occupation. The prevention of it, or at least the management of it, concerned me profoundly. As I had no explanation for my situation, save that perhaps some Old Testament god was acting out a curse upon me, I genuinely felt that by performing acts of charity, or attempting to affect the major events of my life, I might break this cycle of death, birth, death that had apparently come upon me. Having committed no crimes that I knew of which needed redeeming, and with no major events in my life to undo, I latched onto the welfare of Harriet as my first and most obvious crusade, and embarked on it with all the wit my 5-year-old mind, pushing 97, could muster. I used my ministrations as an excuse to avoid the tedium of school, and my father was too preoccupied to see what I did. Instead, I tended to her, and learned, as I had never learned before, how my mother lived when my father was away. I suppose you could call it a chance to get to know, as an adult, a woman I had only briefly known as a child. It was in this capacity that I first began to suspect that I was not my father's son. The Hune family as a whole attended my adopted mother's funeral, when she finally died in that third life. My father said few words, and I stood by him, a 7-year-old boy dressed in borrowed black trousers and jacket from Clement Hune, the cousin 3 years my senior, who had tried, in my previous life, to bully me, when he remembered that I was there to bully. Constance Hune, leaning heavily on a walking stick with an ivory handle carved in the shape of an elephant's head, spoke a few words about Harriet's loyalty, strength, and the family she left behind. Alexandra Hune told me that I must be brave. Victoria Hune bent down and pinched my cheeks, inducing in me a strange, childish urge to bite the black-gloved fingers that had violated my face. Rory Hune said nothing and stared at me. He had stared once before, the first time I had stood here in borrowed clothes, burying my mother. But I, consumed with grief that had no means of expression, hadn't comprehended the intensity of his gaze. Now I met his eyes, and for the first time saw the mirror of my own, of what I would become. "You have not known me in all the stages of my life, so let me describe them here. As a child, I am born with almost red hair, which fades over time to what the charitable would describe as auburn, and which is more fairly carrot. The colour of my hair comes from my real mother's family, as does a genetic predisposition towards good teeth and long-sightedness. I am a small child, a little shorter than average and skinny, though that is as much from a poor diet as any genetic inclination. My growth spurt begins when I turn 11 and continues until the age of 15, when I can, thankfully, get away with pretending to be a boyish 18 and thus skip 3 tedious years until manhood. As a young man, I used to sport a rather ragged beard in the manner of my adopted father Patrick. It doesn't suit, and in its untended state, I can often come to look like a set of sensory organs lost in a raspberry bush. Once this revelation was made, I began to shave regularly, and in doing so, revealed the face of my true father. We share the same pale grey eyes, the same small ears, lightly curling hair, and a nose which, along with a tendency to bone disease in old age, is probably the least welcome genetic heritage of all. It is not that my nose is especially large, it is not, but it is undeniably upturned in a manner that would not be ill-suited to the Pixie King, and where it should be angularly delineated from my face, rather it seems to blend into my skin like a thing moulded from clay, not bone. People are too polite to comment, but the merest sight of it has, on several occasions, reduced honest infants from neater genetic lines to tears. In old age, my hair turns white in what feels like an instantaneous flash. This event can be brought on by stress earlier than its norm, and cannot be prevented by any cure, medicinal or psychological. I require glasses for reading by the age of 51. Distressingly, my 50s fall in the 1970s, a poor decade for fashion, but like nearly all, I return to the fashions I was comfortable with as a youth, and choose rather demure spectacles in an antique style. With these balanced across my two close eyes, I look every bit the aging academic as I examine myself in the bathroom mirror. It is a face which, by the time we buried Harriet for the third time, I had had nearly 100 years to become acquainted with. It was the face of Rory Edmund Hune, staring at me from across the casket of the woman who could not have been my mother.